So, C. elegans is a nematode that lives in rotting fruit and feeds on the bacteria there. As you can imagine, the bacteria are trying to make their own little niche for themselves in this fruit too, and they're at risk from other bacterial species, and they don't want to be eaten by the worm either. So, in order to defend themselves, this bacteria is going to produce hydrogen peroxide, and this is the environment that these poor worms are having to deal with. Hydrogen peroxide is sort of a double-edged sword. In normal happy cells, it's important for signaling that's mediated by reactive oxygen species. However, in the high concentrations that are associated with pathogens, hydrogen peroxide can be toxic because it causes oxidative damage to macromolecules. And this type of damage has been associated with a lot of age-related diseases in humans. People have been studying the mechanisms by which individual cells deal with oxidative damage, and we know a good amount. But we didn't know whether these mechanisms could be coordinated across different cells and tissues in an organism. Now, when I think of an organism-level coordination of a phenotype, the first place that I think of is the brain. And worms do sort of have a pseudo-brain in that there's an area in the head of the worm where a bunch of neurons live. And so we wanted to know whether any of these neurons affected the worm's survival when they're exposed to peroxides. Fortunately, the C. elegans community has taken advantage of the powerful genetic tools that we have in the worm to genetically ablate individual neurons or groups of neurons, and we were fortunate enough to be able to take advantage of their generosity. So we collected a bunch of these strains and we exposed them to 6 millimolar terbutyl hydroperoxide, and we found that a bunch of different neurons are involved in peroxide resistance. So, in the first set of figures, we've summarized the results of our screen. On the left side, you can see that the circle sizes and their colors indicate the size and the direction of the effect that ablating the neuron has on survival. And then on the right, we've organized the results by neuronal function. And as you can see, there isn't one modality that accounts for the phenotypes that we see. Out of this screen, I focused on ASI. It's a neuron that, when ablated, had the largest increase on peroxide resistance. The animals were able to live about 60% longer than wild type. I found that this neuron is sending DAF7, which is a TGF-beta homolog. In the second set of figures, you can see that this is all happening through the canonical DAF7 pathway. The null mutant of DAF7 has a 2.5-fold increase in peroxide resistance, as does a loss of function DAF1 mutant. And both of these increases in resistance are dependent on the transcription factor DAF3. We've also done a bunch of tissue-specific rescues to show that DAF7 is sent by ASI to interneurons where DAF1 and DAF3 function. And I'm not showing that data here, but it is in our paper on the bioarchive. In the next section, we found that once you make it out of neurons, insulin signaling takes over in target tissues, and the common oxidative stress-induced transcription factors, DAF16 and SCN1, are active in the intestine to control peroxide resistance in the worm. In the next section, we wanted to look at how environmental conditions might affect resistance to peroxides. So we know that DAF7 expression is regulated by food perception, and that DAF3 causes reduced feeding via octopamine signaling, and this led us to wonder if food availability is involved in peroxide resistance. So to look at the effect of food ingestion, we used an EAT2 mutant, which feeds less than wild-type worms. And these EAT2 mutants on their own, which is the green survival curve, already live shorter than wild-type, which is in black. So this tells us that food ingestion is important for peroxide resistance. But then when you remove DAF3, which on its own in red has no effect on resistance, once it's in an EAT2 background in orange, it has a drastic effect on survival. And we know that this isn't due to a further decrease in feeding since the EAT2 DAF3 double actually eats more than the EAT2 mutant. This is all suggesting that DAF3 is activated in response to reduced feeding, and this leads to an increase in peroxide resistance. DAF3 is essentially acting as an adaptive mechanism that's partially offsetting the detrimental effect of reduced feeding on peroxide resistance. And so the last thing we wanted to try to address was why food responses and peroxide resistance would be regulated by the same pathway. So to back up a bit, I told you that our survival assays used tert-butyl hydroperoxide rather than hydrogen peroxide. This is a common substitute in the field, and I mistakenly assumed it was because hydrogen peroxide was too volatile to stay in the plates for the duration of the experiment, but that tert-butyl could. What we actually found, the reality of the situation, is that the common lab food source, which is a strain of E. coli called OP50, contains catalases that break down the hydrogen peroxide, but they can't break down tert-butyl peroxide. So that's why we couldn't kill animals on hydrogen peroxide, but we could on tert-butyl. When we switched to using a catalase mutant strain of E. coli, we found that we could kill the worms on hydrogen peroxide, and we found that DAF7 mutants still had increased survival compared to wild type. We also found that one of the worm catalases, CTL1, is extremely important for the DAF7-mediated peroxide resistance, and that DAF7 actually regulates expression of this catalase. This was really satisfying because now we have this bacterial catalase to worm catalase story, and it's an example of interkingdom cooperation on the molecular level. So just to really quickly summarize everything I've told you, sensory neurons integrate environmental cues to coordinate oxidative stress responses via a hormonal signaling relay. It would be really interesting to see if this sort of control is conserved, and if so, I think it could have some pretty interesting implications for diseases that are associated with oxidative stress. So all of this data is part of a paper that's currently under review, but if you'd like to take a closer look at what we found, at the bottom of the poster, I have the link to the bioarchive. And thank you so much for checking out my poster.